We're going to do an old-fashioned Bible study today. How's that? Or a new-fashioned Bible study. I don't know. A Brit Kaddishah type new-fashioned, old-fashioned Bible study. Okay. As you read the Torah, anytime you see pictures of resurrection, pictures of renewed life as a result of deliverance from impending death, and pictures of victory and renewed life as a result of death, you should know that the Torah is about to give you a teaching concerning our Messiah, Yeshua. Okay? You're not going to find him in the New Testament until you read him in the Old Testament. He's there. He's in the Torah all through it. We're going to see if we can find him in today's Torah portion, which probably didn't mean much to you when you read it. But it might mean a lot to you now. These themes are called the resurrection and the life, and they are especially strengthened when coupled in some manner with the number three. Now, I know a lot of you don't like numbers, but the number three is very significant in the Bible because the first living things, plants, grass, etc., were created on day three. This is not strictly life from the dead. However, the principle of life coming from a state in which there is no life is pretty clear, right? The Torah's picture of the resurrection of our Messiah is found in our holy days. The holy day that is a shadow of Yeshua's resurrection is Yom HaBikurim, the Feast of First Fruits, which is the third day, the third holy day of the new year. It's called the day of the Omer, or wave offering. In Leviticus 23, the offering of the barley sheaves, and it's on the day after the Sabbath that occurs during the week of the Feast of Unleavened Bread. And it's a prophetic picture of the resurrection of our Messiah. Jonah, who was in the belly of a great fish, should have been dead, but on the third day, he came forth alive. Truly, death was swallowed in victory there, huh? The Akedah, the binding of Isaac in Genesis 22, was Abraham was supposed to offer a sacrifice Isaac, and it was on the third day of his trip. The manner in which the Torah relates the story hints that Isaac died and was resurrected. That's why Hebrews 11, 17 through 19 records that Abraham received Isaac from the dead through resurrection, figuratively. So how do we know that Moses is a picture of our Messiah? Well, in Exodus chapter 2, verses 1 through 10, there's a few things we need to look at. First was, what was Pharaoh's decree concerning all of the male babies? They were to be thrown to their death into the Nile River, right? So what was supposed to happen to Moses? He was supposed to die. But his mother hid him. For how long did she hide him? Anybody know? 3 months. Three. What did the daughter of Pharaoh do by taking Moses out of the Nile River? She took one who was supposed to die and gave him life. So we see the Torah has painted a picture of a child, Moses, who was supposed to die. His mother hid him for 3 months. Then she obeyed Pharaoh's command by casting him into the water. She put him in a little basket. We could call that an ark. She floated him down the river. But Pharaoh's death sentence was canceled when his daughter took Moses out of the river and he was given life. Life from the dead and the number three all over again. This is the sign of the Messiah. And if it's a sure, it's a sure giveaway that Moses' life will teach us about the Messiah. This story teaches us that Moses' life will be a shadow of the Messiah. Guess what Moses did to Pharaoh? He approached him with three supernatural signs. Three, count them. He turned his staff into a serpent. He made his hand leprous, and he turned water into blood. Think of the sign of the Messiah and guess how all these three things are related. All three demonstrate that Moses had the power over life and death in his hands. He brought a dead object to life, the staff. Turned into a serpent, right? A dead thing into a living thing. Although his hand became leprous, leprosy is a symbol of death, he was able to restore life to that hand. He took water, the symbol of life, and turned it into blood, a symbol of life. But in this case, it kind of connects with death, doesn't it? Moses demonstrated the power of life and death. Pictures of resurrection or life from the dead in the number three are important themes you should begin to look at whenever you read the Torah. Whenever you see that, something's about to explode about the Messiah. If you're not convinced of this, you'll just have to keep reading until you start seeing it for yourself. Numbers 12:3 says, "Now the man Moses was very humble, more than any man who was on the face of the earth." Can you think of a scripture in the New Testament that kind of relates to that? Matthew 11:28-29, Yeshua says, "Come unto me, all ye that labor and are heavy laden, and I will give you rest. Take my yoke and learn from me, for I am meek and lowly in heart, and you shall find rest to your souls." How about that? One of the most outstanding qualities of Messiah Yeshua was his humility. In fact, Philippians 2, verses 5 through 11, states that Yeshua completely emptied himself of his divinity by humbling himself to come to us as a servant. In Exodus, we noted that even though Moses is a Hebrew, his upbringing was totally different from that of his brethren. In the Torah, is the Torah teaching us anything about the Messiah through that contrast? Oh, smile. As a new covenant believer, what do we know about the Torah's picture of the children of Israel in slavery in Egypt? Well, the Egyptian slavery is a picture of the slavery of all mankind to sin, aren't we? Just as the children of Israel could not deliver themselves from Egyptian bondage, guess what? Neither can mankind deliver itself from the bondage of sin. According to Romans chapter 6 through 8, we can't do it on our own. You want to try? Go ahead. See where it gets you. In order for Moses to lead the children of Israel out of Egyptian bondage, he had to make a status change. He was born and raised as a prince in Egypt. Acts chapter 7, 22 and 23 states that as an Egyptian, Moses was mighty in word and deed. However, before he became the leader of Israel, he had to leave his high princely Egyptian position and become like his brethren. He had to become like the Hebrews. When he went before Pharaoh, he did so as a lowly Hebrew, not as a prince of Egypt. What is the Torah trying to teach us about our Messiah through Moses? Consider the fact that Moses did not participate in Egyptian slavery is a picture of how Yeshua did not participate in our sin nature. Amen? Perfect. Hebrew slavery was a Torah picture of man's slavery to sin. Our slavery to sin is a picture brought to us from Hebrew slavery. Yeshua did not participate in slavery to sin any more than Moses partook of the Hebrew slavery. The fact that Moses had to step down from his princely position and identify with his brethren is a picture of how Yeshua emptied himself of his divinity so that he could identify with us and be obedient unto death. He came down as a lowly man. He was God himself. He was his son, his prince, right? In other words, Moses' departure from his princely status to identify with the Hebrew slaves is a picture of the Philippians 2, 5-8 experience of Yeshua where he emptied himself of his princely divinity to become a man of flesh and blood. The Torah's pictures, guess what, folks? They are perfect. In Numbers 12:7. "Not so with my servant Moses. He is faithful in all of my household." He is faithful in all my house. Can you think of a Hebrew scripture from the Brit Chadishah that links to this one? Yeah, I think Jim read it this morning, Hebrews 3, 1 through 6. Note how Paul uses the phrase "faithful in all his house." He obviously had Numbers 12:4 in mind when he wrote Hebrews 3, 1 through 6. "But Christ was faithful as a son over his house, whose house we are, if we hold fast our confidence and the boast of our hope firm until the end." So we know that Moses was a picture of the Messiah. Now we know how he knew this. Life from the dead, and the number three. Notice the type of revelation Moses receives. Numbers 12, 4 through 8. Could this be teaching us something about Yeshua? Well, gee, John 5:20 relates to this. It appears that Yeshua received direct, unhindered revelation from the Father, just as Moses did. As you can see, a high level of prophecy reached by Moses was a picture of the high level of prophecy of our Messiah. Deuteronomy 18:18 says, I will raise up a prophet from among you, or among their countrymen like you, and I will put my words in his mouth, and he shall speak to them all that I command him. And it shall come about that whoever will not listen to my words, which he shall speak in my name, I myself will require it of him. This is a clear messianic prophecy about Yeshua, the Messiah. He would be one raised up from among Israel who spoke Adonai's words. How is this related to Numbers 12, 4 through 8? Adonai expected everyone to carefully heed Moses' words. So likewise, Adonai will hold everyone responsible for acting upon the words of Messiah. Okay? When Jesus talks, you better listen. Forget about E.F. Hutton. As you can see, Moses' prophetic anointing was a picture of the Messiah's anointing. Sometimes we can understand Adonai's plan by looking at the dreams and aspirations of those who understand his plan. In Numbers 11, 24 through 30, what great event occurs? Well, Adonai takes some of the spirit of Moses and he puts it on 70 elders. You know? Please note the wording. He put some of the spirit, some of the ruach that was on Moses, and he put it onto these elders. Note Moses' response to Joshua's complaint about two elders who prophesied in the camp. Then Moses said to him, are you zealous for my sake? Oh, that all the Lord's people were prophets and that the Lord would put his spirit upon them. This is what I call Moses' prophetic wish. It turns out that this actually was the plan and heart of Adonai all along. What great prophecy of the Tanakh is thematically connected to this, to his wish. Anybody ever read the book of Joel, chapter 2, verse 28 through 32? Because it prophesies there that Adonai would pour out his ruach, his spirit, on all flesh. That occurred in Acts chapter 2. We read about that last week, didn't we? Now remember, part of the ruach on Moses was poured out onto the Israelites gathered for the Shavuot celebration. When do you think this all happened, guys? Christmas time? Where did the ruach come from? I'm going to give you a hint. Read John 14, 16. I will ask the Father, and he will give you another helper, and that he may be with you forever. You think the guy showed up from California? No. He came from God. Or the girl. I guess the ruach is sometimes a female. Acts 2:33 says, therefore, having been exalted to the right hand of God and having received from the Father the promise of the Holy Spirit, he has poured forth this which you both see and hear. The ruach given to the Israelites came from Yeshua. Now we can see that the pouring forth of the ruach that was on Moses was a picture of how Messiah Yeshua would one day pour forth the ruach on him onto all the nations. You see, the Torah is just a shadow of what is to come. And now I'm going to give you a deep and mysterious teaching, a goodie for you, a soul-level teaching. Soul is the deepest, mysterious level teaching. Judaism teaches us that Adonai originally created 70 nations in the world. If you have a Chumash, you could read about those 70 nations. You could see how they're formed by viewing the charts associated with Genesis chapter 10. So if you have the Chumash, you could see that. Therefore, when you see the number 70, it usually contains within it a soul-level teaching concerning all the nations of the world. With that in mind, how many elders got filled with the Ruach?
70.
At the soul level, we know that this may have something to do with all the nations of the world. I stated earlier that the pouring forth of the Ruach on Shavuot in Acts was a prophetic fulfillment of Moses' wish. Now, can you think of a connection between the number 70, the number of elders, and the pouring forth of the Ruach to all the nations of the world? Yeah, in Acts chapter 2, verse 5, it says that there were Jews in Jerusalem from every nation under heaven. How many nations was that? Good. This is another confirmation that the pouring forth of the Ruach in Acts chapter 2 is a prophetic fulfillment of the pouring forth of the Ruach onto the 70 elders in Numbers chapter 11. You didn't think anything was there. At the soul level, the 70 elders represent Israelites from every nation under heaven. There are Jews everywhere. You know there's Jews in China. There's Jews in Nebraska. I mean, they're everywhere, these people. Golly. Where am I? I'm in Nebraska. Yeah. It's also a confirmation that Moses was acting as a prophetic picture of Messiah Yeshua. Yeshua poured forth the Ruach unto him, unto all flesh, just as Moses wished. I bet someone from each of the 70 nations was part of those 3,000 first fruits that popped up there in Acts chapter 2, don't you think? Moses was so frustrated with Am Yisrael that he fell into despair, asking Adonai to either help him or kill him. Instead of just asking Adonai to provide them with another source of food, the Israelites murmured and complained. To help Moses, Adonai commissioned 70 elders. Then he filled them with the Ruach. And note that the Ruach has been connected to Am Yisrael's complaints for food. Now, let's look at another passage from the Brit Chadashah that links this point. And this is in the book of Luke, chapter 11, verses 11 through 13, where it says that Yeshua tells his Talmudim that Adonai would surely provide food for them if they would just ask for it. Then he states that Adonai will give the Ruach to those who ask for it. See how this parallels with Numbers? Just thought that was interesting, you know, just an aside there. Okay, now you're wondering what I'm going to teach about today. Actually, I'm teaching about Numbers chapter 10, verses 35 through 36. So it was, whenever the ark set out, that Moses said, "Rise up, O Lord, let your enemies be scattered, and let those who hate you flee before you." And when it rested, he said, "Return, O Lord, to the many thousands of Israel." This is a very unique passage in the whole of the Torah. You may not know this, but Hebrew essentially has no punctuation marks in it. You know, there's no dots at the end of sentences, no question marks, no quotes, no commas, nothing. For the most part, the text just continues to unfold letter after letter, line after line. The only major interruptions are the breaks in the Torah portions. There's a break between each parsha. Also, every once in a while, some letters are unusually larger or smaller than the rest of the text around them. We know that every kosher Torah scroll like we have has been copied perfectly since the first scroll penned by Moses. Therefore, we surmise that Adonai intentionally placed these few anomalies within the text. We also surmise that they are present because of thematic considerations. Unfortunately, many non-Jewish believers in the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob have no appreciation for the beauty and the wisdom of the Hebrew text. Please join me in prayer that all those Gentiles, that their eyes would be open to the beauty of Hebrew, that they would learn. And I know you guys love Hebrew, but the people you know in all these buildings around town, they don't know Hebrew. and they just discard it as being nothing. But it is so awesome, as many of you have found out. Numbers 10, 35 through 36 is particularly unique because it has a unique set of markers that set it apart from the rest of the text. And if you have a Chumash, you can see this. You will notice that Numbers 10, 35 through 36 is set apart from the rest of the text by two inverted nuns. The letter nun is inverted around each end. It's equivalent to the letter N in our language. In the Hebrew text, it's impossible to miss it. But what do they mean? Why did Adonai inspire this section of text to be set apart from the rest of the text? Well, the only answer I can give you is the answer proposed by the sages of Israel, the Jewish people. In the Talmud, in Shabbat 11, it says, it refers to these two verses as a separate book of the Torah. That's right, the sages of Israel felt that these two verses were set apart by Adonai to indicate that they have a complete message all by themselves. If this is true, then the book of Numbers would actually be three books of the Torah. Numbers 1 through 10:34. Then Numbers 10, 35, and 36. And then Numbers 11, 1 through 36, 13 would be three different books of the Torah. This would make a total of seven books of the Torah instead of five. Interesting, is it? How do we come to this conclusion? You got to read Proverbs chapter 9, verse 1, where it says, "Wisdom has built her house." Didn't we always say wisdom is a tree of life to those? Yeah, that when we do the Torah. "Wisdom has built her house. She has hewn out seven pillars." So it tells you in Proverbs that there's seven books of the Torah. In this interpretation, the Torah is seen as the ultimate wisdom. Therefore, the Torah should have seven pillars, making Numbers 10, 35, and 36 a book by itself. We arrive at seven total books of the Torah. The sages of Israel that the many layered messages of Numbers 35 and 36 was so powerful that it deserved to be a book in its own right. So what is the key event in this passage? The key event is the going forth of the ark. We know the ark represents Adonai's throne, where he dwells between the cherubim. Therefore, the lifting of the ark is a picture of Adonai lifting himself to go before Am Yisrael. Where has the Torah mentioned Adonai before, going before Am Yisrael? He's mentioned in Exodus 23, 20, 23, 23, 23, 27. I'm just going to go on 23, 28, 23, 29, and 23, 30 of Exodus. Most of these verses state that the reason Adonai went before them was to destroy their enemies. This is exactly what Moses prayed in Numbers 35b. In other words, the main theme is warfare. In last week's Torah portion, we introduced the subject of warfare. The Haftorah to last week was the life of Samson. Certainly, he was a warrior. He was one of the main ways Adonai repeatedly used Samson, was used as an instrument of wrath against God's enemies, against Israel's enemies, especially the Philistines. He always went to battle against them guys. So Samson was used by Adonai as a warrior defending Israel from their enemies. Let's go back to the garden of the only garden I know, the Garden of Eden. Remember the promise Adonai made to Adam and Chava concerning her seed in Genesis 3? 14 and 15, he promised them that the seed of the woman would one day crush HaSatan's head. In fact, we know that this aspect of warfare has been present throughout the covenants Adonai made with the patriarchs and Am Yisrael. In Genesis 22, 17, Adonai promises to Abraham that his descendants will possess the gates of their enemies. And when was this to occur? It's about to happen now. Now, it's time for Am Yisrael to enter into a new phase of the covenant with Abraham, the spear of warfare. In the view of this new dimension of the covenant, Moses prays that Adonai would rise up, go before them and destroy their enemies, thus making good on the promise of Abraham in 22:17. Putting this all together, the theme captured by Numbers 10:35b is warfare. In order for Israel to be successful in warfare, guess what? They need Adonai to rise up and destroy their enemies. How do you think a nation of 6 million Jews can go against 82 million Arabs? You can't. Numerically, it's impossible to win a war like that. I mean, look what happened at the Alamo. They only went 200 against 5,000, and they got overrun. It's impossible, but God has to rise up. And he's done it six times already since 1948, and he's going to do it a seventh time. That's going to be the completion. Seven is a complete number, for those of you who don't care about numbers. Now let's look at Numbers 10:36. And when it rested, he said, "Return, O Lord, to the many thousands of Israel." And when he rested, he said, "Return, O Lord, to the many thousands of Israel. Rest, O Lord, among the myriads of Israel." This is kind of difficult to translate. Many English Bibles render it as number one above, which is the one I read first. "Return, O Lord, to the many thousands of Israel." Another accepted translation is that the myriads of Israel be returned to their place. The word "return" is used in the sense of bring back, as in, "The Lord will bring back thy captivity," Deuteronomy 30, verse 3. Lastly, in number 3, "Rest, O Lord, among the myriads," Adonai is asked to rest among Israel. So, the first interpretation, "Return, O Lord, to the many thousands of Israel," seems to focus on the wilderness experience. After Adonai had gone before Israel to destroy their enemies, Moses then called for him to return to them. The second and third interpretations have begun a prophetic interpretation such as they apply to all generations. So we've seen that Numbers 10, 35, and 36 reinforce the theme of warfare. Now let's see how significant is the placement of this passage within the book of Numbers. Okay, in Numbers 1, 3, what's the purpose for numbering all of Israel, for doing the census? Well, it seems that they were establishing an army. And if you look over Numbers 2, you'll see that there's a purpose for the specification of the encampments of the tribes. They're positioning themselves in a martial array, as in the manner of an army. When an army lays down its camp, certain groups get put in certain areas. As you can see, the theme of warfare has now become a dominant theme. Why? Because they're about to march into the promised land to inherit it. However, there's one small problem. There's people that still live there, and they don't want them. They have to be destroyed before Israel can inherit the land. Although this has been the plan, according to Genesis 14:16, it is now only now that Israel is ready to go in and possess the land. Why were the priests numbered and assigned their tasks in last week's portion? Because they were given responsibilities for how to transport the Mishkan, the tabernacle. So now we can determine a theme for Numbers chapter 1 through 10:34. And it would probably be preparation to journey into the promised land. Okay? That's the first part of Numbers. The first book of the three books of Numbers. It's called that. The preparations included the establishment of an army and the establishment of responsibilities for transporting the Mishkan. And so then, what major transaction occurs in Numbers 10, 33 through 11, 3? Here, Yisrael started the journey from Mount Sinai to the Promised Land. That's right, until this point, they'd been encamped at Mount Sinai. Now they actually began their journey. They started moving. They've been at the mountain all this time. This is a major shift in the ongoing narrative of the redemption of Israel. If you were to read Numbers 11 through 26, you would see that it chronicles the journeys of the generation that left Egypt and makes their way to the promised land. So now we have a context where we can place those two little verses in Numbers 10. From Numbers 1 through 10:34, the general theme is preparation to journey to the promised land. From Numbers 11 on, the general theme is the journey to the promised land. Therefore, Numbers 10, 35, and 36, it's right in the middle of these two shifts in the theme. So if you look ahead, if you were to read Numbers 11 through 26, you would see the narrative moves from one problem to another. They just go from one thing to another, and it just gets worse, doesn't it? Beginning in Numbers 11, it's not difficult to notice that almost every event in Israel's journey is characterized by rebellion and calamity. Story after story revealed to us that Israel refused to do what was necessary to actually go in and take the land. Although the nation made many mistakes during the period of the Exodus and the giving of the Torah through Adonai's grace and forbearance, they were able to recover and fulfill His will. Until Numbers 11, Am Yisrael have seen Adonai's mighty hand of deliverance. They received the Torah at Mount Sinai. They received the Shekinah to dwell among them in the Mishkan. However, once it was time to actually go and take the land by military conquest, the people faltered beyond recovery, ultimately doomed to perish in the wilderness. What happened? What went wrong? I'll save that discussion for later, because that's in the later chapters. For now, I want you to see the great transition that occurs in Numbers chapter 10, verses 35 and 36. Before that passage, Israel is riding high, man. They got the whole world in his hands. Afterwards, they sink to the depths of rejection. Oh boy, my world has just crashed. The considerations are the reasons why the sages of Israel place so much emphasis on these two verses. They form a buffer between two extremes which are found in the book of Numbers. The strategic placement, along with the unusual punctuation mark, speaks of their importance. So why are they so important? Well, Exodus 23, 20 through 27, records the promise of how Adonai will bring Israel into the land. Numbers 10, 35, and 36 records how the promise of Adonai in Exodus 23 was supposed to be fulfilled. That was the way it was supposed to happen. The passage in Exodus 23 shows us what should have happened, Adonai's original plan. It represents the ideal scenario. This is the way I'm going to do it, God said. Had Yisrael not rebelled, the invocation in Numbers 10, 35 through 36 would have caused a realization of Exodus 23, 20 through 27. Therefore, the two short verses describe what could have been, what should have been. Conquest of the promised land should have been a piece of cake. I mean, if you've got God as a secret weapon, how can you lose? Instead, Numbers 11 begins to describe the tragic reasons why that particular generation was doomed to die in the wilderness. Now we see that these two verses can be viewed as an entire book. The sages of Israel saw that within that passage, a message so powerful that it could stand alone as its own book of the Torah. Let's see the real reason why this message is so powerful. Please read and think about these particular words. Arise, O Lord. Do you see any prophetic message in these words pertaining to Messiah Yeshua? Couldn't guess? Okay, let me help you out. See, I'm here for. Think of the sign of Messiah. Think of the main point of the message in Acts 2. Yeah, the verse is asking Adonai to arise is exactly what Yeshua did. He arose from the dead. Arise, O Lord. It was a few years late. According to that part of the book. The main point of Peter's sermon in Acts chapter 2 was the resurrection of Messiah Yeshua. Arise, O Lord. And he surely had. Can you believe it? This shows how Judaism is so close and yet so far from the truth. The sages of Israel had the wisdom to see the power in these two tiny verses. Yet, they refused to see the real reason for its majesty, and it is its thematic connection to the great work of our Messiah, Yeshua. Also note the connection between the verse, the phrase, "Arise, O Lord," and the phrase, "Let your enemies be scattered, and let those who hate you flee before you." Do you see a connection here? The scattering of Israel's enemies is connected to the Lord arising. We've seen this before. Remember the Akedah, the binding of Isaac? After Abraham was willing to offer Isaac as an olah, a whole burnt offering, Adonai promised that his seed would possess the gates of their enemies. In other words, the Torah connects this event of the Akedah with the promise of Am Yisrael ruling over their enemies, possessing their gates. We know the Akedah was a prophetic picture of the death and resurrection of the Messiah. We talked about that before. Therefore, Numbers 10:35 teaches us that Yeshua will gain victory over his enemies, possessing their gates through his resurrection. This is not the last time the Torah will make this connection. We know this is true because Colossians 2:15 and Hebrews 2:14 and 15 say this: "Having disarmed principalities and powers, he made a public spectacle of them, triumphing over them in it, the execution stake." And Hebrews: "Inasmuch then as the children have partaken of flesh and blood, he himself likewise shared in the same, that through death he might destroy him who had the power of death," that is the devil, "and release those who fear of death were all their lifetime subject to bondage." Pray with me that Adonai will continue to open the eyes of the Jewish people so that they can see these wonderful truths concerning the redemption in Messiah Yeshua. And Numbers 10:36 has three possible interpretations. Once again, let's see the real reason. This is a soul level interpretation of the power of these words. Let me see what it says. "And when it rested, return, O Lord, to the many thousands of Israel." First, let me ask you up front, and when it rested, do you see any prophetic message in these words pertaining to Messiah Yeshua? Here's another hint. The deeper meaning of this 10:35 was fulfilled at Yeshua's first advent, was it not? Okay. So Numbers 10:36 will pertain to what? His second advent. Okay, make the connection. Yes, return. Return, O Lord. What does that mean to you? It's a plea for Yeshua to return for the second coming. Oh, wow. Isn't that awesome? Excuse me while I get excited. You guys can fall asleep if you want. Wake up, wake up. The kingdom is here. Yeah, it's a plea for him to return. The third interpretation also has this soul level of understanding. "And when it rested, he said, return, O Lord, the many thousands of Israel." So as I stated earlier, this translation is a plea for Adonai to return Am Yisrael to him. If this translation is one you prefer, has the messianic message been lost? No. So what is the power of this verse? Well, what other event occurs along with his second advent? What happens when Yeshua comes back? Come on. The resurrection of the righteous. Wake up! Wake up! The kingdom of the Lord is here. Wake up. Stand up if you have to. Y'all falling asleep on me. That's right. When Am Yisrael returns, when Yeshua returns, all of Israel will be resurrected and returned to the land. We're not going to heaven. There's no beer there. We're going to Israel. We're going to Jerusalem to live. You ain't going to have to get on Continental Airlines. You ain't going to have to fly LL. You will meet him in the air and he will take you there. Pack your cameras. You know the great regathering of all Israel in the sky from one end of heaven to the other. You know, it's all in 1 Corinthians 15. Read it. This is the great event many erroneously refer to as the rapture. This is the regathering of all Israel. That's what it's all about. You know, both Jew and Gentile alike will join together, and it'll occur in the sky when Yeshua returns. First, the dead in Messiah will be raised. All the dead all around the world, not just those graves we saw on the top of the Mount of Olives. All of them, all at the same time. You could spend $50,000 for a grave on the top of Mount Olives, but ain't going to get you any quicker resurrected than the dude that's living in Valley, Nebraska in a cemetery. It will occur in the sky when Yeshua returns. First, the dead in Messiah will be raised. Then those who remain, if you're still around then, guess what? You're going to be changed. You're going to be caught up to meet him and taken to the land as a new creation. So the real reasons for the powers of Numbers chapter 10, verses 35 and 36, both events seem to pertain to the greatest work ever of our Messiah, Yeshua. His resurrection, and guess what? Ours too. That's the power of Adonai. By the way, if you really want a good commentary on those two verses, I suggest you read this wonderful book that came out years ago. You want to write down the author? Name is God. It's called The Book of John. Thank you.